You're listening to The Pulse, where it's all about student news, student opinions, and student voices.
Hello and welcome to The Pulse. This is URN's daily news show, broadcasting on weekdays and bringing the news that matters to you. I'm Ben, and joining me today we've got Rebecca, April and Rory. So coming up for you today, the Health Minister, Lord Bethell, has said that nurses are well paid for the job. As the debate over the proposed 1% pay rise continues, we'll be discussing how much they should be paid, and this is on the same day that NHS England's Chief Executive, Sir Simon Stevens, said that they had previously been offered a 2.1% rise back in 2019. Full-time residents of Lenton in Nottingham are saying that they are leaving the area as it has become party central during the lockdowns. Residents of over 20 years have said that the city's two universities have done nothing about their complaints. In Myanmar, a nun has been photographed urging heavily armed police officers to shoot her instead of the children. The country is struggling with the aftermath of a military coup on the 1st of February when civilian leadership was arrested. And the return of the cruise. The Maritime Minister Robert Coates has reportedly told the parliamentary group that cruising could return at the same time as other holidays when they're legalised on the 17th of May. But with everything that we've seen over the last year, will people want to return to the high seas?
This is URN.
So that's all coming up, but our first story today is coming from April, who's going to tell us about nurses' pay. April.
Yeah, so you did cover the story briefly. It's basically around the fact that the Health Minister has defended the proposed 1% pay rise for NHS staff, and he said that the nurses are well paid for their job. However, obviously other MPs like Labour and Lib Dem have said that this is a kick in the teeth and it's really not very fair for NHS workers. And you did mention something which I kind of thought was the main point of the story, is that the head of the NHS, Sir Simon Stevens, confirmed that it was budgeted to be a 2.1% pay rise, but it changed because of the pandemic. So originally they were going to give a 2% pay rise, and then because of the pandemic, maybe the government has less money and they're choosing to take the money away from the NHS workers, people who have, you know, been our heroes through the pandemic. So I just wondered what your opinions were about this. Obviously, the government only have a limited amount of money, but really the NHS, I think, should be a real priority in paying them a good wage.
It does seem a bit ridiculous, seeing as how much money they've spent on other things during the pandemic, like billions and billions of pounds on different things, which maybe weren't essential. And I think there's going to be like a big economic hit anyway. There's going to be a lot of debt. There's going to be a lot of spending. And I think adding extra pay for the nurses probably won't add that much to it in general. I think it's interesting that the minister who said it, Lord Bethell, I mean, I always slightly distrust ministers when their hereditary peers in the House of Lords, literally put into the House of Lords because of who their father was. So I think it's a bit ridiculous coming from him saying, you know, they get loads of money and loads of benefits for their job when they're actually not paid that much if you look around it, when he's just been given his job because of where he was born.
Yeah, I feel like also people are a bit cross because nurses were sort of promised, well, just generally NHS staff, that like there would be benefits coming from having to deal with, you know, COVID in such a difficult circumstance and also following cuts to the NHS, but this seems like not to be the case. It just seems like they've attempted to sort of I don't know, do something more for the sake of it so that they can claim that they haven't broken that promise, but in reality, you know, it's not really fair.
Yeah, I think what's definitely really interesting, like you mentioned, April, is about the kind of the previous promise of a 2% pay rise, which I guess, as it was brought forward in 2019, was probably something to do with the election, which feels like a millennia away these days. But I guess that maybe it was just a promotion thing for the election. And I think to go back on it is... it's quite mean, kind of, given the circumstances and the fact that the kind of pay for people in the public sector, not just like nurses, but everyone in the NHS and everyone working in the public sector, many of them key workers, salaries have been frozen for a lot of the 2010s, and many have received kind of under inflation pay rises. So I think that 1% pay rise is not going to be enough for people to kind of catch up with the standard of living that that inflation increases every year.
Yeah, I agree. I think the 1% doesn't seem, you know, it seems like sort of the bare minimum kind of thing. And people were saying about how the government have promised more and now they've delivered, you know, a lot less. And in Scotland, it's actually kind of the other way around, in that they're having ongoing discussions which are going to be happening in the summer about the future of pay rises. But for the moment, they're having an interim pay rise for their NHS staff of 1%. So basically, the government in England, the English government, are giving 1% as sort of like the final kind of deal for the next year or however long. And they're not really considering whether they should be paying more or not. Whereas in Scotland, they are sort of showing that they are appreciating their NHS and they're going to try and work out how to pay them more. And the 1% is like the minimum they're doing just for the interim term. So I definitely think that the government could do more, and especially as they'd already budgeted for 2%, to sort of go back on that and make it only a 1% pay rise, it doesn't really feel like maybe the government are reflecting, you know, the public's opinion of the NHS, which is that all the people who work for the NHS are like real heroes and they've dealt with so much during the pandemic that they definitely deserve more than 1% pay rise. So I think it's definitely like worthwhile them going on strike about, and they really need to fight for it because they do deserve more.
So kind of just kind of bringing back then, how do we think that if they're only going to get a 1% pay rise, there is a thing in Northern Ireland where NHS workers were promised a one-off £500 bonus because of their work, and there's been the case in some supermarkets and stuff like that. So do you think that would be an alternative way to go about it, given that if they can only do 1%, then why don't we give them an extra £500? Because I think there was something about how this 1% pay rise would only kind of work out at £200 to £300 or so a year in extra money. Do you think that something like the government is doing in Northern Ireland, where it's a £500 bonus, do you think that nurses would look favourably upon that?
I still think it's not enough, like, either way. So either the 1% clearly isn't enough, and that isn't enough either. I mean, if you look at the salaries that a lot of, in an article, they sort of listed the salaries of nurses, and they're saying, you know, the lowest minimum salary is £18,000, and the starting salary for, like, the most qualified, newly qualified nurses is £24,000. And for what they do, it seems like a very low amount of money. So I think even that sort of lump sum of £500 or whatever, it just doesn't seem enough. It seems sort of like, oh, a bit of a token, really, not really meaningful change.
Rebecca, April, what would you think to a £500 bonus? Do you agree with Rory?
I agree. It seems... Sorry,
go ahead.
I agree as well that it seems a bit, you know, they're just doing something in the short term, whereas increasing the pay, obviously, more than 1% would be more beneficial in the long term. And it would seem like they're just throwing money at it now to try and, like, make it go away just in terms of the £500. But it would be something, obviously, and I'm sure people would be grateful if they did get the £500 bonus, because at least it's something, but it's still not enough. So I think Rory put it really well.
Yeah, I think it's quite an honest idea. Like, you can see specifically how much they're getting more than just like a percentage, which is sort of a bit, I think, harder to comprehend. Like, if you know, involves maths to work out. But I also wonder whether it's not enough. And what's interesting is that I feel like nursing has gone from previously being not like an unsafe profession. Obviously there are always dangers within that profession, you know, you're always working in a slightly more dangerous environment, but I feel like now, because of giving COVID situation, it's so much more dangerous. And in other occupations you get given what's literally referred to, I think, as danger money in some professions. So like, as if you work in psychiatry and things, because there's a statistical chance that you might get hurt or injured by like a patient. Whereas nurses obviously aren't normally given that, as far as I'm aware. So I wonder whether something like that should be implemented given the circumstances, and because we don't know how long it's going to last. Like something maybe a little bit. The problem with the £500 one-off thing is it sort of seems like, you know, this hasn't been going on for a long time, and I suspect it will continue to go on for quite a long time as well.
I think another thing to think about is that recently, especially given the pandemic, they've kind of come up with lots of statistics that kind of show that lots more people have been encouraged and, you know, enthused by the pandemic to join up to the nursing profession. Do you think that this will be kind of a short-term trend, or do you think that it will kind of last now that we've kind of seen the, you know, the heroic effort? But also, I guess, on the to counter that, do you think that people would be put off from joining the profession based on the kind of the levels of pay and kind of the whole controversy surrounding it?
Well, I don't really know too much about it, but I feel like in the past nurses haven't been paid too well, like for a long amount of time. So maybe this is nothing new in terms of them like having to fight for the money that they deserve. But I do think that like the public opinion of nurses, and it's really inspiring, all of them, and everyone who works for the NHS has been obviously dealing with so much during COVID, that it is inspiring to, you know, even I don't do anything to do with medicine in my degree, but I really have a lot more respect, I guess, because like we were saying, it's putting their lives in danger even more than they already were. So I think it will be, I hope that the inspiring aspect of it outweighs any sort of people who might be put off by the danger, but I think it's inspiring.
Yeah, I mean, I think so too, but I always sort of get reminded of the Olympics, and when they were like, oh, the Olympics will make everyone do exercise and stuff, and it sort of lasted for about a couple of weeks. And I don't know if that will be the same thing now. I hope not. But I think it's, you know, it's a really positive thing when we're lacking lots of nurses and doctors in the NHS anyway. I think it's a really positive thing that more people are wanting to join.
I think it's like a really, yeah, also like a really positive thing. My only concern is whether people will sort of be inspired and join, which is really great. But then when they actually have to, you know, be a nurse under really difficult conditions, like in the sense of like cuts to the NHS, because that's what a lot of staff complain, is that they're having to do, you know, a lot of really long hours, and sort of have to hold up any of those cuts and so on for as part of the NHS, whether people then will drop out as a consequence, sort of a bit like with teaching, has quite a high number of people who go into it, but then a very also high dropout rate. I don't know.
I guess that will be something that will have to be seen. And actually, just to come back to something, a point that April made earlier, you kind of talked about strikes, April. So I was wondering that kind of, even though we're kind of still in the middle of the pandemic, do you think that would be a responsible course of action if they do end up with the 1% rise?
Well, I don't know if it would be responsible, and I feel like obviously everyone in the NHS is really caring for their patients, and they wouldn't want to have a strike any time, but even more because of the pandemic, I guess they're so understaffed and they have so many more patients, especially in like ICU. So I think it would really take a lot for them to strike, and at the moment the unions are threatening to strike, but I think maybe at the moment it is just a threat, and it would take maybe this continuing and the government like not agreeing to go into talks about increasing the pay rise or giving them any sort of bonus or anything. I think the like the threat of the strike at the moment is sort of to try and get the government into talks to hopefully do more, which obviously it would, if the government don't give them any money, like, you know, a strike is the last resort, and obviously it wouldn't be good because, you know, people are in the hospitals, you know, they're dying from coronavirus, but at the end of the day, people who work in the NHS and the nurses, you know, their lives are massively affected by the pay they're getting. So I don't know if it would necessarily be responsible, but I can see that obviously they have reasons to do a strike.
And what do you, Rebecca, Rory, what do you think if there were a strike? Like, people are, certainly there's kind of talk about it. What would you think?
I think it probably, I mean, I feel like it maybe won't happen, but the threat might force some movement on government. I mean, government have said loads of things in the past that they've gone back on, so there's no reason why they won't necessarily do it on this. But I think strikes tend to be quite damaging, and a lot of the time I think they don't really do that much. So I don't know if it would be the best idea at this point, but yeah.
Yeah, it's difficult to know where, like, public sympathies will lie. A lot of the time when you have strikes, obviously, I think the public can be quite unsympathetic, but given everything that the nurses have been doing, it's really hard to know whether or not people think it's inappropriate during a pandemic or really, like, necessary and understandable. I think it certainly puts into question, like, whether, you know, all the claps for the NHS, how far that sympathy actually goes. You know, does it go into supporting strikes, or is it just more of a sort of I don't know, like, just people prefer just supporting from the sidelines. I'm not really sure, but you would think that people would be supportive. It's just hard to know because of the pandemic.
Yeah, and so I guess we'll have to see where that goes. Of course, the 1% rise and everything is subject to review and confirmation, so no doubt there will be ongoing discussions about this. So let's move on to our second story of the day then, and that is about full-time residents in Lenton saying that they're leaving after the area turned into party central during lockdown. So lots of students from both the University of Nottingham and Nottingham Trent live in Lenton, and residents living in the heart of the area are saying they're planning on selling up and leaving after weeks of illegal gatherings and bad behaviour by students. Police responded to 5 reports of antisocial behaviour in Lenton over the weekend, including 2 parties in Derby Road and Harrington Road, where a total of 28 fines were issued for breaches of the coronavirus legislation. One resident who has lived on Lenton Boulevard for 22 years said she can no longer live in an area where her sleep is constantly disturbed. Others described the sheer volume of house-to-house mixing by students who seem to have a complete disregard of the rules during the lockdown. Many are pointing the finger at the two universities for not taking action despite so many complaints. One resident who's lived in the area for the 22 years and suffers from multiple sclerosis says that her health is now at risk because of the illegal gatherings. She says that she rarely calls the police or the university about the problem, but she says in the last few weeks it's gone absolutely crazy. She added that the door next to me is always full of people. I phoned on Monday and Friday and the police came out pretty quickly. I was then working at 6 a.m. and they were on the roof and partying. It's a constant stream of groups coming round at night. I want to leave. So there are lots of residents quoted in the article about the problems that are being faced in Lenton by full-time residents. So do you think that students are getting the blame for breaches of coronavirus when it's unfair? Do you think that this is more of an accurate picture? And do you think that it's a small group of students ruining it for everyone?
I think it's, I mean, first of all, it must be really horrible to be in a place you've lived in your whole life and feel like you can't live there anymore because of other people. Like, I can't imagine being at home and think, oh, I literally hate living here because of what students and other people around me are doing. But I have, like, quite a lot of sympathy for the residents of Lenton. But I mean, I think it probably is a smaller group of people. I think it's probably a smaller group of people. I think most people are following the rules. Most people aren't going to parties all the time. But even a small group of people, even a small percentage of the amount of students who live here, that can have such an enormous impact. You know, one house party could wake up a whole street. So I think while it is a small group of people, I think it's right to look at students and look to the university for a solution.
Yeah, I agree. I think the university maybe has to like be strict if people get found up to be holding parties and things. And I know obviously some people have been expelled if it got found out they hosted like big house parties. I don't know if that was more recently, but obviously at the start of lockdown, and like that was quite a big thing that university were trying to like promote students to put out a positive view to the residents who live in Lenton permanently. But I guess in a way it's easy to blame students, and there's always going to be a small minority of people who are going to break the rules. And maybe if it was an area where there wasn't so many students, maybe there would be less of people in that group who would break the rules. But there's still going to be some people who are going to break the rules, and maybe it's just easy to blame it on students because that's maybe, you know, it's more clear that it's students. And obviously it's not good that these people are breaking the rules and having house parties, but I don't know if necessarily all of the people are students. And maybe you know, I just feel like sometimes students are easy to blame, and obviously they are part of the problem because they're part of society. And overall, I think society needs to just try and follow the rules and follow the lockdowns and not host massive parties, because like the government has a plan for getting out of lockdown, and I guess some people just can't wait, but other people hopefully are thinking like, if we can just carry on for a little bit longer, it's gonna really reduce the death rate and everyone's gonna be a lot better, and you're not gonna get in trouble with the police or anything, which is a bit unnecessary, especially if you're a student and you're gonna get kicked out of university for it. So I think a lot of students probably are thinking, you know, try and be sensible, because at least it's gonna be better for you in the future.
Yeah, I agree, April, in particular, that like, I don't know that these always are students. I mean, I would assume that most of them are, because obviously it's a very student area, and perhaps in this case she specifically knows that they are students, but it's quite hard to tell from like a group of young people that they're necessarily anything to do with the universities, because I imagine it's probably quite a good area just to live in generally if you're a young person, and you know, because of where it is in the city and so on. So it's hard to know that this is definitely to do with like the university. And also, I don't really know what the university can do apart from, you know, say like if you're found to host a party, etc., there'll be consequences. It's difficult for them to control. I wonder whether the police maybe should be doing more things. I mean, I know that when I was in Nottingham, I did see police cars sort of just hanging about. I think they were maybe just going around the areas to frighten people off. But I don't know. Maybe there should be more permanent situations with the police. I'm not sure.
So I think definitely there needs to be some kind of better oversight of what happens in Lenton, because I mean, by all accounts, it sounds like on some occasions it can be quite quite wild, I guess, and that's definitely that definitely some of the residents do not like. I think kind of just bringing out slightly more broadly, kind of away from the coronavirus aspect of it, do you think that students, when they're kind of living in these areas, do you think they kind of pay enough attention to the people who live there full time? Because although I don't live in Lenton myself, I mean, I can't say that I've really thought a lot about the people who are the permanent residents in Lenton. I mean, this must be the first story kind of in the, you know, 2.5 years that I've been here that has made me think, oh, there are people who live here like day in, day out, even though it's a very studenty area. So do you think that students who kind of live in Lenton forget that there are people who are, you know, who live there full time, you know, slightly older and don't want to kind of live the student lifestyle all the time?
I think it depends on the person, really. I mean, I live in Lenton. I've always tried to be respectful of the people around me, but it's hard to know. You look at most of the houses around Lenton and they're student houses. But yeah, I know. I think it depends. I think some people's attitude is, you know, I'm away from home, you know, I can do what I want now, I'm going to go a bit crazy. And that's obviously not great, but it's sort of a natural expectation. And I think, you know, the university has been here for quite a long time. Lenton has been a student area for quite a long time. I think unless you've lived here for ages and ages and ages, you would be moving into a student area. So it's sort of something you've got to expect. But yeah, I think there are a lot of people who don't really see it as a community to live in, more as just a place to be and do what you want with. Because I think most people probably think their home isn't here, it's at home kind of thing. But yeah, no, I don't think it's everyone, but clearly it's impacting a lot of people, and that's a shame.
Yeah, I would just add that you said like a lot of students probably, you know, maybe some people maybe don't think of the people who live around them, but I guess because it is such like well-established area in terms of students, people probably just assume that because most of the people they see are students, most of the people that they live near are students. But I guess it only takes one household where, you know, maybe it's like an old woman, or, you know, like there was a woman who said about they had health problems and they couldn't sleep. And, you know, it's really affecting that person's life. And it, I guess even in like an area or a street that has majority of students, it just means that there's more students there that potentially could cause noise or disrupting other people on the street. And I guess maybe people should try and think about the other residents more. But like, you know, it's kind of hard to say, tell people how to live their lives, because they are, you know, sort of having that first freedom away from their parents potentially. And especially because in Nottingham, like in the first year, you live in halls. So when you get the chance to live, you know, in your own house with your friends, and people really seem to be taking advantage of having parties. Obviously, the coronavirus really should make people think twice and not to be breaking the rules and hosting house parties. But I guess they, even in non-coronavirus times, people should probably be more considerate of the other people who are not students who do live in Lenton.
Yeah, I feel like no matter where you live, like there's always a risk that you're going to be next to somebody who, you know, you don't necessarily get on very well with, or that they, you know, make a lot of noise and so on. But I think also like students need to be considerate of the fact that not everybody has, like, you know, the social mobility wise, like not everyone can choose exactly where they live. So they need to be considerate of residents who have maybe perhaps even lived there for like a long time, and consider that home or can't move elsewhere, and just to be like generally respectful, like not to break the law in this case because it has really severe consequences, but also because, like, you know, just general things like noise is, you know, just be considerate of other people. Don't have like parties really loudly at 3 a.m. Obviously, I know that's like really part of the student life, but I feel like there are ways that you can enjoy yourself without affecting others negatively.
And so I think kind of just to finish off this point, really, so in the future, do you think there could be better communication between the students at university and kind of the full-time residents of Lenton? Because at the minute, it seems like that is a bit of a missing link.
It's really hard, I think, because you've got a city which isn't huge. Nottingham isn't enormous, but there's a lot of students. There's tens of thousands of students, and they've got to have somewhere to live, and ultimately they are going to be concentrated in one area. So I think it's really hard if you're a student to have a impact in your community when your community is almost entirely students anyway. Some people probably think, well, I don't know any local residents, so how will I get involved with the community? But I think, you know, maybe that communication with those small amounts of local residents would help. And I'm sure there are more people who live here permanently than most students realise. So I think that potentially would be the solution to this whole issue.
And
I also,
Rebecca,
I think it's Sophia is the community officer, I'm not sure if that's correct, but my impression that I got from sort of her and her updates about how she's been getting on with like speaking to the residents was that it was going quite well, like the residents are generally speaking quite understanding, but obviously I think given the circumstances it's quite extreme, so maybe it's just the circumstance that we're currently in and it will like eventually improve.
Now let's have a look at what's going on around in the world right now. So, Myanmar experienced a military coup on the 1st of February, and last night we got a striking image of a nun begging in front of heavily armed military police officers. So Rory is going to take us through this story for us.
Rory. Yeah, so the article was about this nun who was in front of, is a very striking picture of her in front of these armed officers, telling them to stop shooting at the protests, because I think a couple of protesters have been just killed on the spot by the police. But I think it, you know, opens a wider conversation about what's going on in Myanmar and maybe the international reaction. So earlier this year, I think it was the 1st of February, there was a coup, essentially. The generals, the military, decided that they didn't like the election results. So they just thought they would say, you know, they're all wrong, they're all fake, and then arrested the civilian leadership. And it's caused huge turmoil in a country which has been in a lot of turmoil since independence in the late 40s anyway. So they're used to this kind of, you know, insurrection, coup, that kind of thing. So I think it's interesting also to see the international reaction. It hasn't seemed to be that much of a reaction from Western countries, especially when talking about democracy, especially when you look at what happened in America and that whole rhetoric around, you know, democracy, we've got to protect democracy. Yet, in front of their very eyes, there's a country which has gone to authoritarianism from democracy so quickly. And there doesn't seem to be that much reaction, that much positive response from any of the Western powers and any of the large democratic powers. So I think it'd be just interesting to ask whether you think it's any of our business, whether we should get involved in any way, like should we get involved just diplomatically, military or anything like that? Or is it, you know, it's another country, it's not our business. I'd just be interested to hear what people think about that.
Well, I don't know if we should get involved necessarily, but obviously this story was about the nun and, you know, in these protests, people are being shot and killed. And this nun was, you know, pleading for the children. It says, you know, she's trying to basically plead with the police and the army to not shoot people, because I feel like obviously it's a different country and the UK or, you know, other Western countries maybe shouldn't get involved, but when it's got to a state of like the governance of the country where people are being shot in protests, I feel like that sort of is very, you know, disregardful for like the democracy and like the way that I think literally majority of people in the Western world would like our, like I couldn't imagine if the UK went into sort of a situation like this. It's really shocking, and I feel like for the UK to not, well, not necessarily the UK, but like for all of the Western sort of countries to not really get involved, even when situations like this are happening, where people are being shot in protests and children are being shot at, I think it's kind of like, that's the line. You need to protect people's lives, even if they are people in another country. They don't deserve to be shot at while they're just protesting against this military coup.
I think it is very... It kind of puts other countries in the West, you know, in a difficult position. You know, I agree with you that these, you know, nations such as the UK can't really get involved, because I think trying to get involved in a foreign country is just a kind of a recipe for disaster, really. And to some extent, these coups often can kind of just go their course, really. But it's very difficult to kind of see, like you say, the images of kind of live rounds being fired on protesters, you know, who are protesting against a coup that arose out of an election. And, you know, Myanmar had made lots of progress in coming to some form of democracy, although it wasn't great because the military still had, you know, lots and lots of power. It wasn't democratic by any means, but it was more democratic. And then it was just all taken away again because the military decided that they didn't like the result. And that is something that is fragile and the kind of democratic countries need to speak up about. Because if you kind of look at the other side of the coin, there are
it was China, for example, when the coup happened, they said that it wasn't a military coup whatsoever. It was just a significant cabinet reshuffle. So I think you kind of then see through that statement the face-off between democracy and authoritarianism right in a country which has been stuck between the two of them for quite a while.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about this situation, I think it's interesting to look at maybe the past 20, 30 years of Western intervention of any sort in countries around the world in the name of democracy. And clearly that, you know, that whole idea of intervening in another country, whether it be with the military or in any other means, is quite tainted. You know, we think back to like the Iraq War, the second Iraq War, how disastrous that was and how that led to so many disastrous things in the Middle East and so much instability, which is there now, even though the war was 15, 16 years ago. So I think any kind of intervention by the West would have to be quite, not weak, but nothing military, nothing hard. It had to be a lot of diplomacy, a lot of things like that. And realistically, that doesn't work very well. So I think it's going to be really difficult to sort this situation out if you're, you know, a diplomat in a big, powerful Western country. And I don't really envy them because you have clearly human rights abuses and situations where people being killed on the street. Yet I think the public would be against any kind of intervention to stop that. So it's a balancing act, I think, between what the public want you to do and the kind of moral responsibility to the people in those countries.
Just to kind of focus in on one of the points that has been thrown about during the whole military coup is over the status of Facebook, because Facebook was originally criticised for not taking down posts which were kind of spreading the kind of pro-coup propaganda, lots of fake accounts, and then they were also shutting down accounts, and then the military tried to take Facebook offline altogether. So what do people think about kind of social media's role in all of this, and do you think that has helped or hindered the people who are protesting against the coup? Rebecca, what do you kind of think about that?
Well, I think it should normally, like, if you have the, provided the government isn't sort of censoring you and you can actually use things like Facebook or other social media platforms, theoretically it should help. It depends what's going out, I suppose. If it's propaganda by the government, then obviously not, but if it's like images sort of a bit like this photo, like if we hadn't seen this, you know, we wouldn't know maybe that this is happening. So I think it can be very useful as a tool to make people aware of what's going on in a country, but equally I think it can be abused.
Yeah, and I guess Rory was saying before, like, with foreign countries, it's kind of a balancing act between whether you, like, get involved or don't, and, like, to what extent you get involved. And I guess the media kind of has a similar role in that they can't get too involved by taking down too many posts, or, you know, then they will get, like, accused of censorship, or if they don't take down certain posts, then they can annoy other groups. Like, it's like a lose-lose situation because it's a balancing of these different groups with very differing opinions. And obviously for the protesters, you know, social media, and it can be very helpful for them, like, to organize their protests and to find out, you know, that I guess the level of support from the public for the protesters and against this military coup. But yeah, I guess it's kind of hard to know how much Facebook could do about it, because at the end of the day, they don't want to, you know, get in a bit of a argument with whoever is in charge at the moment, because that could just cause even more problems.
Mm-hmm. And so obviously they're going through a very difficult situation, which is currently ongoing. So we'll have to see what the end outcome will be. And we don't know how soon that will be either. And now moving on to our final story of the day, it's that domestic cruises within the UK could become legal and become started again after the 17th of May, when other internal UK holidays become illegal as well. So to take us through what could happen, Rebecca's got the story for us.
Yes, so domestic cruises in the UK could resume from the 17th of May, according to the Maritime Minister. So basically, under the current roadmap for easing lockdown restrictions, 17th of May is the earliest date which could see foreign and domestic holidays resume. Obviously, P&O cruises have said that they are delighted by the acknowledgement, which isn't that much of a surprise. And the roadmap that Boris Johnson's roadmap has said that basically indoor dining, hostels, hotels, and B&Bs could open in England from the 17th of May, depending on factors such as the prevalence of coronavirus and how the vaccination rollout is going. International travel could also resume at that date. What I thought was interesting is sort of given, I think, when this first the coronavirus was sort of breaking out in the country, there was sort of controversy, I think, over cruises and also just generally how the UK was handling people going in and out of the country. Do you guys feel that the 17th of May, obviously it's not, you know, a fixed date, but do you think maybe this is a little bit early, bearing in mind how much of the virus was like going around on cruises? Like, I remember that being quite a lot of the stories were on those.
I think things have to open up sooner rather than later, because there's clearly like a problem with, you know, the economy. You have to balance the health and the economy, those two factors. And the health situation of people getting vaccinated, especially people who were probably more likely to go on a cruise because they're probably older. So I think it seems good to set a date, maybe something for the industry to work towards. And they've basically been shut down for over a year by that point. So I think, yeah, it's good to set a date, but I think as long as that date is movable, depending on the science. But I think it's a positive step. I think a lot of people, you know, be able to book cruises and it'll make them feel much better after the year we've had, I think.
Yeah, I don't really know too much about cruises. I've never been on a cruise, but I guess they're going to be setting up some like coronavirus measures similar to like when you travel on a plane and things like, you know, you have to wear a mask when you're, I guess, in the communal kind of places. And there's going to be a lot of thought, you know, like Roy said, they've been shut for around a year. So they're going to have lots of people within that industry working, you know, to come up with ways to make it safe so they can open as soon as possible. And I guess it's obviously good news for the cruise businesses, but also for the people who want to go. Hopefully they feel that the measures that are going to be in place, I don't know what the measures are going to be, sorry, I don't know, but hopefully they're going to have thought it through well, because they're not going to want a situation where there's coronavirus on their cruise ship, are they? They're going to be doing everything to make sure they can have as many people feeling safe and wanting to go on the cruise. So it seems like a positive thing, and obviously the date is movable, but for the moment it does seem like it could be happening on the 17th, and I think that should be the 17th of May. That should be good if they do have measures in place.
I think this is definitely a good sign for the whole cruise industry, because, you know, like you were saying, Rebecca, I can remember when we were covering it on The Pulse right back probably about this time last year, when it was the Diamond Princess docked out in Japan, which became kind of one of the symbols of the early part of the coronavirus, where people were trapped in, you know, their cabins with no natural light for 2 weeks on end and stuff like that. And we thought, God, this is terrible, and this is, you know, kind of, this surely must be kind of the death knell for cruises, like, given what we've seen. But obviously, they've struggled so much, and now they want to come back. I think it's a very kind of interesting take on them, given that it's kind of UK domestic cruises. And I'm not sure how many UK domestic cruises there were beforehand. I know that there were definitely kind of quite a few going from UK to other places. But it seems to be a new reinvention of cruising, and they're going all around the UK. And so I think kind of if that's your first holiday away for a while, then why not?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've said that they, they've got new measures in to try and, you know, be as socially distanced and safe as possible within the cruise. Obviously, I suppose the issue with the cruise is that, like, you know, you're all in sort of, you're using all the same areas and so on, you're all sort of mixed in a bubble. But on the other hand, they have had a long time to sort of think about the ways in which they can make it as safe as possible. And also with our rapid testing, I wonder whether maybe something like that will start being implemented, where before you get onto the cruise, you have to have like a test and so on. I know they're not always 100%, but generally speaking, I think that would help. So maybe, you know, this will be a safe way for people within the tourism industry to be able to, like, well, for the tourism industry to be able to get going again. Because obviously it's nice that, I think, if you work in that sector, to have a reassuring date as to when you might be able to go back to your job and so on, just for the industry. I think it's kind of good news overall.
Mm. And so, is everyone looking forward to the re-legalisation of holidays on the 17th of May?
I mean, like, I kind of am, but I haven't planned to go anywhere. Given also the dates, like, you don't know what's going to happen, I guess. It's hard to definitely plan.
Yeah, some people probably would be, like, willing to go on the first few days when you can, but like Rebecca was saying, if it's not really sure if it's going to happen or not, and obviously the date could get put back. I also haven't booked anything, but I think it is a good, for the people who are really desperate to do something or like go on a cruise or something like that, it is good that they at least have a date that they can look forward to now, even if that date does get pushed back a bit. But at least for now, they're looking forward to it.
Yeah,
I think it's good that there's a date, but I mean, I'm not going anywhere, I'm not going on holiday.
So when do you guys think that you'll be able or be willing to go abroad again then?
It's hard to know.
Yeah, like it's difficult. I think it's difficult to be sure because it, well, A, it depends when like people perceive it safe to go. And also I suppose it's when everything starts going back to what feels like normal. Like I think people are hesitant because everything, like, I'm not at university right now because obviously I'm not supposed to go back because of my course and stuff, so maybe when normality sort of resumes in your everyday life, people will feel more confident to sort of go on holiday and so on.
And I guess we'll have to see where that is, when that is even. So that's all we've got time for today. Thank you for listening to us here. The Pulse is always on your end, 1350. You're on 1350.net, Monday to Friday. Thank you to Rebecca, Rory and April for joining me here. That's all from us. Goodbye.
This is URN.